Today's guest is Margaret Lomas. Margaret is an author, public speaker and financial advisor who is in demand as a speaker at financial expos, shows and seminars all around Australia. She is resident financial commentator on 2GO's Real Estate Show, 2WG's Property Show and Bay FM's Breakfast Show, as well as a regular guest at Melbourne's 3AK, Perth 6PR and ABC with Tony Delroy. She writes articles for investing magazines, including the popular Australian Property Investor, to which she has contributed many cover articles. She also writes for Wealth Creator magazine. She has a diploma in financial advising, a diploma in human resource management, and a certificate in franchise management. Is an affiliate member of the Securities Institute of Australia and the founder of Destiny Financial Solutions Proprietary Limited. Margaret lives in New South Wales with her husband, Reuben, and their five children. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
Thank you.
Margaret, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, how long have you got? How long did you say this interview was going to be?
A quick overview.
Okay, a quick overview. Well, I'm 44 years of age, and this would be an appropriate time for you to jump in and say, 44? You don't look it, Margaret.
You don't, actually.
No, you don't have to be nice to me. It's okay.
21, I was
thinking. Oh, yeah. Well, look, you don't have to lie. I'm 44 years of age. I have five children, age ranging from 19 is the oldest down to 9. I run a national company called Destiny Financial Solutions along with my husband, Reuben. And I also have written a number of books. That's pretty much it, I guess.
It sounds really easy, but there's a little bit more of the story than that, isn't there? Where did you come from to actually get started in this industry?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And anybody who's made a success of anything in their life, I guess, will tell you that it's amazing how you're perceived as having been an overnight success, but in reality, there's often 20 and 25 years behind that. For me, there's probably not quite that long. I've been married twice. I had a fairly typical marriage with the first marriage and a fairly typical financial life. We tended to always have a bit too much week left over at the end of our money. We tended to always be a little bit behind the eight ball. We did own our own home from before we got married. We bought a little one-bedroom unit out at Cabramatta in Sydney, and we lived there for a little while. So we always owned a little bit of real estate, but we never really got ahead with that real estate. And I'm sure it's a typical story for most people. We divorced after 10 years and I married again, and I married someone who had exceptionally good money habits, and I had yet developed that myself. So I guess together we worked very, very hard. I tended to have a lot of talents in the area of being an extrovert, being an opportunist, an ideas girl, but I didn't necessarily manage the money well at the back end, and my new husband did. So together we made a great team, and we worked very hard, firstly on our own financial lives, and that was from when I was 30 years of age, and secondly on developing a business of our own. So I guess it's been 15 years, almost 15 years now, that we've been working really hard, first of all, to get our own finances right, and then to be able to teach other people how to do what we've done.
Okay, so just going back to that turning point in your life, not everyone can go and marry someone who's got great money management skills.
No.
Okay, so what can we learn that the listeners can take and use?
Okay, can I say that I don't think it's because I married someone with good money skills that I then went on to build a successful life of my own? Because before I met him, I actually had, I guess, what a lot of people would call a bit of a defining moment, and I don't know that we will all have these without thinking about it, but you can probably make a defining moment of your own. I do remember getting up one day after I'd been separated from my first husband. I had three children under five. I'd always refused to receive a sole parent's pension because I felt even though I could make more money on a sole parent's pension than I could getting the small amounts of work I was getting, I was really convinced that that was going to create an attitude in me that wasn't right for me. It was going to create that whole why should I work when the government can give me money attitude, and I knew that wasn't going to be right for me. So I always worked, and you know, there were often nights there where the four of us would sit together on the couch and cry over the fact that there was just no time and there didn't seem to be a lot of money and we didn't know how we were going to get ahead.
What type of work were you doing at that time?
Back then I was working in a community-based service, and I was helping unemployed people find work. And it was a service that was a 10-hour a week job when I got the job. But because that nothing's ever good enough for me, nothing's ever good enough for me, I worked really hard on that job, and it was a government-funded position to increase the funding to the project. And eventually I increased that into a full-time position for myself, and it ended up being a full-time job for about six people by the time I was done with the project.
Not bad.
And we certainly helped a lot of people into employment as well, which was really good. We achieved some good outcomes in that. But I do remember waking up one morning and saying to myself, you know, I never want to have this feeling of being broke again. I never actually want to sit down and think, how can I pay the bills and always be that one step behind? And that was the first day that I guess I started to send out those affirmations that people talk about. Now, I'm still a bit of a skeptic. I don't know you can send stuff out into the universe and actually get anything back. But I do know that what it did for me is that it started me having a far more positive mental attitude, and it opened my mind to more possibilities and opportunities.
Would I be right in saying that you actually made a decision and then you focused on that decision?
I think that's what it is. I don't think it's about anything. I don't think I embarked on any kind of spiritual journey like a lot of people would like to say, or I don't think I attracted anything to myself in particular. I think I just said, no more. I'm not going to be like this anymore. From today on, I'm going to work hard on opportunities that I see. I'm going to try just about everything, because I guess in Australia, we tend to be a nation of skeptics. We tend to be always looking over our shoulder and looking backwards for the trick or the catch.
Yes.
Rather than looking forward and knowing that if there's a trick or a catch, I'll get over it and I just won't do that again. So I tended to then try more things that in the past I would have said, oh, I'm not going to do that because I might get caught.
What are we talking about here?
Just all sorts of opportunities. Look, like anyone, I probably tried network marketing for a little while, because we all do that at some time,
for
I
sure.
Think. It's the first thing you think, there's a business opportunity. I learned from that experience. We actually did quite well with network marketing, but we did learn a lot about people. We learned a lot about business. We learned a lot about people saying no to us, and not feeling bad about that and feeling better about ourselves, and our self-esteem grew. I learned how to take knockbacks better. So I learned to ask for things, you know, my job, which as I said was 10 hours a week. I learned to push really hard at that and do what I could to try to increase the hours and get other people to give me work and get other people to give me opportunities, when in the past I wouldn't have asked. I would have said no, they might say no, so I'm not going to ask about that. So I guess it was really more about opening my mind a little, telling myself that the only way I was going to get ahead was if I did it for myself, and trying everything that came my way.
Taking action.
Taking a lot of action and accepting that it's a little like a pack of cards. If I gave you a pack of 52 cards and put a joker in there somewhere, you'd know that it was there somewhere.
Yes.
And it might be card number 51, and I might tell you you've got to flick through the whole pack. You'll keep going knowing that there's 52 cards and it's in there somewhere. It was like that for me. I knew that my opportunity was going to be out there somewhere. I was convinced of that. And all I had to do was flick through the pack and try everything to finally get the opportunity that was right for me.
Okay, so what happened then? What was that next turning point that created this future?
Okay, I can remember a bit of a funny story, and there was a little bit of an element of luck here, although I believe without the element of luck we still would have been okay. But we decided, I had a house that I'd bought off my ex-husband that I basically had no equity in. I'd mortgaged myself to the hilt to buy this off him, and the market had softened just after I paid him probably more than I should have for it, and I was left with no equity in a home. When I met my husband, he owned a small part of the house that he lived in with his mother, and she essentially bought it back off him, and he ended up with $2,000. And we decided that we would sell the house that I had lived in, and we'd buy a block of land and we'd build a house. And I sold my house and came out minus $2,000. So you could say that together we then had nothing. We were even. We had no debt, but we had nothing. And three children and a St. Bernard dog. And we decided that we were going to buy a block of land. And I can't actually remember how I thought I was going to do this. I was pretty convinced that the bank would give me some money. We didn't have any money, so I wasn't quite sure how it worked. And I think probably what happened was I can remember getting a contract for some training work. I actually am a training consultant by profession from years ago. I worked in Westpac Training. I remember getting some training work, and the contract was going to give me something like $8,000 for the contract. So I was able to actually convince a bank manager back in the days when you could do this, that based on the $8,000 contract, that he should lend me $30,000 to buy a block of land so I could build a new house. I wasn't thinking at the time about where I was going to get the money from to do the building. I just wanted the block. Anyway, we looked around at some blocks of land, and there was one we wanted to have that we just didn't. We were going to be about $10,000 short on it. So we'd settled for something else, and we were quite happy with that. We came home one day from work, and the phone was ringing. And we'd been out looking at display homes months before. And my husband answered the phone, and I could hear him saying, "Really? Really? I can't. That's incredible. Really? So what? I have? Fantastic." And I'm in the background jumping up and down going, what's happening? Anyway, in the end, he got off the phone and he'd just won a car. And it was this tiny little micro or some ridiculous car that you could not fit three children and a St. Bernard dog into. But it was a brand new car that he'd won, and he'd filled out a ticket at one of the display homes that we'd looked at, and that's how he'd won it. What it did for us is that we sold it immediately, and it gave us $10,000 extra, and we bought the block then that we wanted.
Amazing.
Which was, so there's a little bit of luck there.
Yes.
We then kept the block for a little while and then decided to own a build on that to save some money, and we ended up pulling together some more money again. And look, the way we did that was, and we were still really in our courting phase at that stage. We were living together. We'd known each other for about a year. But I had children. We accepted that there was going to be no, you know, fantastic entertainment for us as a couple like you normally do when you're courting. A fun night for us would be putting the children to bed early, going down to the local Chinese shop where they had dinner specials for $5, buying two of those and a video for $2.50, and putting the fire on and staying in. Yes. And we did that every Friday night and had a great time doing that. So we never spent any money. We just really, really budgeted like crazy and were very careful with our money and saved very, very well in those first couple of years that we were together.
Okay, that's good. Okay, what happened then to get you into this business?
Okay, that's interesting, because at the time I'd moved from the community-based service into a business called the Australian National Training Company, which was my company. And I was actually one of the first people to ever have a Train the Trainer course nationally accredited. Back before anyone knew about Train the Trainer, I wrote one and it was accredited by Canberra. So we were very proud of ourselves. And I used to run corporate training programs for unemployed people and a whole lot of different things. And one day, and I also used to help people to write resumes and application letters, because I'm good at that. I was very good at that, and I could help just about anybody get a job. And I had a bit of a reputation for being good at that. So people used to come around to make extra money. People used to come around to my house at night, and I'd write their resumes and I'd write their application letters, and I'd charge them $10 and be another $10 for the mortgage. And a fella came around one night and he said, "Oh, look, I've got to race home because I've got a fella coming tonight to tell me how to pay off my mortgage more quickly." So be it that I always listened to anything that people said and looked at opportunities myself, I said to him, "Look, get him to give me a call. I want to know how to do that too." And this is way back in the days when lines of credit first became popular and no one knew anything about it. Legend has it that four guys in a pub sat down on the back of a coaster and worked out how you could use a line of credit and a credit card in such a way that you would pay off that line of credit more quickly than you could pay anything else off. They took the idea to the market, charged ridiculous amounts of money to tell people about it, and so created a business. And these were the people who came to see me.
Right.
Anyway, I really liked the the idea, but said to the fellow, well, I'm not giving you the $5,000 that you want to do that for me. I'll do it for myself because I think I can, and which I did. Went out and spoke to my bank manager, rearranged my finances at the time, sat, and my husband, who was a police officer at the time with entirely too much time on his hands, was teaching himself how to do software programming at the time. He said, well, look, I think I can write a program that we can then use to run our finances in such a way that we'll know what we're doing every day and we'll be on top of it, et cetera, which he did. We liked what we were doing so much that I, again, with my fertile mind, said, well, I think this is a business opportunity for us because we can probably teach other people how to do what we've just done for ourselves. And that's when Destiny Financial Solutions was first born.
Very good. So what at that stage, where were you financially?
Okay, financially I was living in Perth. I'd moved into the house that I'd owner built. I think we'd paid a total of around about $110,000 for that, a six-bedroom house near the beach, 20 minutes from Perth, because we'd owner built that. We had a little bit of equity in that. It had gone up to around about $180,000 in value, so we had about $90,000 equity. And we were paying off our mortgage pretty fast because both of us were working quite hard. My children, some were in daycare, some were in school, but I was doing any work that I could do, doing the extra work after hours with the resumes, and we were paying that down pretty quickly. And then we started to see clients. We started to do a little bit of advertising that was mainly word of mouth through our friends who always knew that Reuben and Margaret always have great ideas and we should look at them and follow them. Mm. And we started to help people to set up their own finances a little more effectively and then help them to pay off their mortgages more quickly. And we charged them a fee to do that.
Okay. So at that stage, you were in control of your own financial destiny.
I was in control then. We didn't have a lot still, but we were starting to get on top of it. We'd proven that we could operate our finances better by being more careful with our money. And, you know, we didn't go without everything. I don't want you to think that we were at home, you know, having a rotten life because we never did anything. I do remember things, though, like a treat for the kids would be a 30-cent McDonald's cone. So that'd be $1.50 for ice creams in my family. That'd be pretty easy. We could manage that. We did a lot of things with the children on the weekend, like we would take walks with them to the park. We'd pop them in the car and take them somewhere nice. In Perth, there was a water playground that didn't cost anything to get in. You could give a donation, and it was just a series of fountains and pools and things like that. Well, we'd take the children there. We'd go and we'd buy, or I'd actually cook a chicken, and we'd pack lunch, and we'd take little fruit boxes so we didn't have to buy drinks while we're out, and that kind of thing. So we still had fun as a family, but from a financial point of view, we weren't very far, but we were in control. We were most definitely in control of what we were doing.
So at that stage, you'd set up a system so you could control your finances.
And look, it's important that you say that, Gary, because that's exactly what we did. We set up a system, and to this day, I can tell you that out of all of the clients around Australia that today we help to not only manage their finances better but invest in property and build a substantial property portfolio, it is only the clients who consistently use the systems that we provide for them who actually get ahead. When our clients get in trouble and it doesn't work for them, you can guarantee it'll be someone who isn't following the system. They're not using the tools that we give them.
Go back to basics and use the system.
Absolutely. You have to have a system. And what the system does for you, even more than giving you a system, is it makes you aware. See, most people aren't aware. You ask them, what do you do with your money? Most people say, I don't know. It just tends to go. Once you become aware of what you do with your money, you're actually in a position to be able to make choices and decisions. And you might say, well, I'm not going to do that because this is the impact it will have. I can remember one of my very first clients who lived in my street, and they were people who weren't terribly good with money. They did earn a lot of money, but they weren't good with money. But they were keen and enthusiastic, and they could see what we had done, and they wanted to copy that. So we set them up with their, first of all, we set their finances up the right way. So we helped them to get the right kinds of loans. We gave them a program and went and taught them how to use that. We showed them how to do some more effective budgeting. And I can still remember going back and seeing them about 3 months later. And the woman said to me, you know, Margaret, I worked out today that I give my children $15 a week to spend at the canteen on morning teas. But if I bake cookies on a Sunday, I can actually save something like $14 or $13 a week, which if I put that in my mortgage, that's going to make a big difference. Now, she never would have thought of that.
That's
but
right.
It was because she was in control. She was watching what she did. She was enthusiastic about the progress she was making and keen to make it happen even faster.
But Margaret, a lot of people out there, you know, they sort of look at budgets over the years and it never works. They just haven't got the discipline to follow it.
I know why it doesn't work. I know the secret with budgeting. And look, again, let me reiterate, I am not talking about dramatically changing your lifestyle. I'm talking about sitting down and working out what it is you need to spend to keep the lifestyle that you want to keep reasonably, and then formulating the kind of budget that allows you to have that. Today, of course, my budget is different than my budget used to be because I have more money. But the realities are you've got to work with what you've got. You've got to understand that unless you can win lotto, which is only going to happen, it's a 1 in 8 million chance, then the only impact that you can have on getting more than what you've got today is to work on it today and create wealth for yourself. The secret to budgeting is this. When people write a budget for themselves, what they do is they sit down and write the budget. They might come to the end of the month and go, oh my gosh, I blew the budget. I'm going to do better next month. That's not going to happen. The secret to budgeting is tracking and being able to establish before it happens when you're going to get into trouble. And so what we do with our budgets is this. We write a budget. I hate the word budget because that indicates slashing or cutting.
Yes.
The word income and expense management plan is a lot better word, I think. It's a lot more descriptive for what you're doing.
Yes.
So if you write an income expense management plan, and we certainly do that for our clients, then we give them some very comprehensive software to run it. Let's say, as an example, that you've allowed yourself $100 for gifts for the month. You track your expenses, and week one, it only takes 10 minutes a week, you record what you've spent. Week two, you record what you spent again. You get to week two and you see that you've spent $70 in the $100 that you're allowed. You know that for the next 2 weeks you only have 30 left. You can't spend the same that you've been spending. So it's about knowing where you're at, having a halfway point through the month, and then doing what you can do for the next 2 weeks to fix it. It could be that you've overspent on your food budget and you can't cut that back, but you've got to cut back somewhere else in order to fix that up. So, but successful budgeting is all about looking ahead and guessing where the problem areas are going to be before they occur and fixing it before it happens.
I can just hear someone out there saying, does that mean I have to count every cent, every 5 cents that I spend?
No. What we try to do is we allow an amount that is for discretionary spending. You know, you're going to have a cappuccino down at the cafe. You're going to give the kids a couple of dollars for the canteen. So we have an amount. The only time when I get tough on my clients is if they start drawing $100, $200, $300 cash a week from their savings or their line of credit and they can't really work out where they've spent it, then that person does need to start counting every cent for a little while. But if you have like a petty cash float, it might be $100 a week. For me, I'll go along on Monday. I'll take $100 out of the bank. That's for my little expenses that I'm not going to track, my cups of coffee and my bits and pieces. And then what I do with that is if the next Monday I've still got 20 left over, I'll take 80 and top it up. If I've spent it all through the week, I'll get a little bit more out. But if that starts happening too often, then I've got to start to ask myself, well, what are you spending that on? Because
yes,
if it becomes too big an amount, then it becomes a problem in the budget.
So can people really get control of their finances?
They can get control of their finances, but I don't want everybody to get caught up and think this is all about just budgeting and then you'll get ahead. I know there's a very famous couple of books out there that talks about doing things that I think are probably a little bit bizarre in order to get ahead, like, you know, brewing your own beer and making your own dog food and things like that. Look, that to me, that's not what life's about. We work hard today. We need to be able to have some enjoyment today. And some of us just don't want to be cooking our own dog food. And, you know, I'm really not talking about that degree of watching your budget. I'm just talking about being a little bit smarter with your money, trying to know a little bit more about what you do with your money, but at the same time, starting on an investment plan to leverage what you're doing today.
Yes. Just going back to the budget thing, it's more about awareness, isn't it? It's about knowing where you spend your money and giving yourself choices.
Absolutely.
It's about not being at the end of the week saying, I haven't got the money to pay the mortgage or to pay
yes,
whatever.
Yes.
I can choose what I want to do.
That's right. It's about knowing and saying, okay, I want to spend $100 a week on entertainment. Fine, if you've got it. Pay the mortgage first, pay the bills first, and then do what you will with what's left over. And that could be reinvesting it back into the mortgage if that's what you want to do to accelerate your position. Or it could be spending it at the club if that's what you want to do. So long as at the end of the day you don't sit there at a barbecue with your friends and whinge about your financial position because you've been doing things along the way that maybe you didn't need to do.
Yes. So one thing is the knowing, but the most important is also having the financial plan.
The plan is the most important thing because it's a little like saying, well, I want to go on holidays, but I have no idea where I'm going to go. So I'm going to wake up one morning and just go on holidays. I know some people can do that, and those same people are probably the people who run their lives like that. You need an itinerary for your life. You need a plan for your life. You need to know what you can achieve. One of the things that we try to do in the company that I run is we give people a 15-year plan, and it says to them, given what you've told me about how you want to spend your money today, so allowing for those things you might want to spend money on today, we know that you can buy a property to the value of X dollars in month 6, in month 20, in month 37, in month 42, and we will give you that plan that says this is when you can buy those properties. Now then, that will happen for you if you have told us accurate things about how you want to spend money, and then you monitor it and you spend money the way you tell us you're going to spend it, then you will be able to achieve whatever plan that we give to you.
Okay, so coming back to your company, what you do there is help people to develop a plan for their property future.
Exactly. We don't sell property at all. So when it comes to buying the actual property that the plan says you're going to buy, you buy what you want. Of course, we educate you about that. As you know, I've written a number of books on property investing. Not only do we do that, not only do we provide the books for you, you have to read the books, of course, because they're our Bibles, but all of the staff in the branches then help you to put this plan in place. I want everybody to know that the way I make money are two ways. I make money by investing in property. And so since I've done that so well, and I look a bit bleary-eyed today because I've spent the last 3 days at night on the internet buying more property for myself. So it takes a little while, but not too long. Not only have I made that happen for myself, but I write about exactly what I've done so you can do it too without having to go through everything I went through to learn those things. I don't sell education. I don't make money from selling education. You can come to one of my seminars for $20, and that just covers the venue costs.
That's incredible.
Well, it isn't incredible. You think it's incredible because we've got people whose names I won't mention who are selling courses for $10,000 and $20,000.
More.
What will happen then is that you'll get yourself into debt coming to my course, and then you're behind again. I don't need you to pay me to tell you what I know, because what I know makes me money. I make money from doing what I'm going to teach you to do. I also make money, of course, from running a business. I'm a businesswoman. I've worked hard on that business. I've built that for years and years along with my husband, and we deserve to make money from that now. We make money because when people come to see us, we'll charge them a professional fee, just like any accountant, financial planner, or doctor will, or lawyer, we'll charge you a professional fee. So I make money in business, and I make money in property investing. I don't make money from selling what I know.
Okay, so let's go back to your business because I love your philosophy about education and making it relatively inexpensive.
Yes.
So firstly, with the business, what do you actually do for someone if they come to you in your business?
Okay, if somebody comes to us, the first thing we do is we send them away if they haven't read the book, because really everyone can get everything they need to know out of the book.
If they want the book,
yes.
How can they go and get your book?
Oh, books are in all the bookshops.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. They've all been bestsellers, so that's been fortunate for me.
And they've got a new book out recently, haven't you?
Yes. What I did, and just to explain very quickly about why I wrote another book, there are three books in the property series, or in the how-to property series, that are all different, and really someone would need to read at least the last two or all three, depending where they're starting from. I had a lot of people write to me and say how much they love the books, but what they had to do with them was sit down and try to extract the information to write themselves a process on how to buy the property. So I thought, well, obviously I need to do that for everybody. So the new book is The Process. If you pick that up and start on page one, by the time you get to page 233, you will own a property that is tenanted. And that's the plan for the book.
Very good.
It's got checklists and worksheets, and you can't move on to the next chapter until you've completed all of the steps in the chapter before, ticked off your checklist, and then you move on to the next step. It'll buy you a property.
Okay, well, tell us the name of the book.
Okay, that's please. Called The Pocket Guide to Investing in Positive Cash Flow Property, but you'd need a very, very big pocket to fit it in because it's a bigger book than I expected it to be.
Yes.
And it doesn't replace the other books. A lot of people think, oh, I should buy the latest book because it's got the latest information. It does refer back to the other books a lot because I don't go into lengthy discussions on the concepts if you don't understand the concept of positive cash flow property, which is what I write about. You need to read some of the other books to learn about that.
Okay, so the older books are still relevant today.
Oh gosh, yes, still relevant. I mean, look, the first book I only read in 2001, so we're not talking a long time ago anyway.
Well, still a lot happens in that short time.
It does happen, and I guess in some respects what the books are almost like a plan of the journey that I've had. You know, when I look back on the first book, there's still everything in it's relevant, but I think, gee, there's a lot you didn't know then. And then I wrote about what I didn't know the first time in the second book, and then I wrote about what I didn't know the second time in the third book.
Yes.
So they really take you through that journey yourself, and they provide you with lots of information.
There's five books, isn't there?
Yeah, well, yes. There's actually seven. There's How to Make Your Money Last as Long as You Do. And that's also in a New Zealand edition. So I rewrote for the New Zealand market. There's How to Create an Income for Life. How to Maximise Your Property Portfolio. I wrote How to Invest in Managed Funds just because I could. I'm a financial advisor at the end of the day.
Yes.
It went bestseller, but I think that's only because the National Australia Bank bought up thousands and thousands of copies and gave them away to all of their online traders. So that was good. And then there's The Pocket Guide to Investing in Positive Cashflow Property. And I have written a personal development book called 6 Steps to Superwomandom. Very big mouthful.
And is that available too?
Yeah, sure it is, yeah.
So check any of those out in any good bookshop.
The bad ones have it too, believe it or
is
not.
Is there a bad bookshop?
I don't know. I think there is. They'd be bad if they didn't have my book.
But that's right.
Yeah, so when a client comes to us, what we like to do is we like to provide them with this plan to help them buy the property and then give them all the tools that they need and all the support. So we don't sell property. We help people to buy it, but we help people to buy it using a financial advising approach. Most people, when they buy property, use their emotions. It's wrong. You can't use your emotions when you buy property.
Yes. Now, we're not saying that the people in your businesses are all financial planners, are we?
No, they're not. I'm a financial advisor. Strangely enough, and I think this is wrong, ASIC does not require anybody who advises on property to be in any way licensed.
Right.
And I think that's wrong, and I hope they move toward a time when they need to be licensed. At this stage, property is not considered a security. It's not considered a financial instrument in the eyes of ASIC. So you don't have to be qualified. Having said that, I am qualified. I have a diploma in financial advising. I train all of my branch managers consistently and frequently so that they too become as qualified as I am. And I also insist that all of my branch managers are working on their own diplomas in financial advising.
Okay.
Some of them are almost finished now. It can be up to a 4-year course for them if they're doing it via correspondence, which they have to because they're so busy with the business. But they all have to become qualified. And so you can know that my branch managers have consistent education all of the time.
Okay. So what you said earlier is that if someone comes in and they haven't read your book, you send them away?
Yeah, we send them away.
Then they come back,
okay.
And what happens?
Okay, then and understand that some people feel they can do it themselves, and that's a good thing. But there are a lot of people who do like to have some help, and that's the service that we provide. So from that point on, we would have a financial analysis drawn up for that person, taking into account their own income and expenses and any of their particular financial goals or financial needs. So it could be, Gary, that you might say to me, well, look, at the moment, my wife and I are both working and this is how much we earn, but in 3 years' time we would like my wife to be able to leave the paid workforce to have children and she'll be out for 5 years. We try to make that financial analysis reflect that,
right,
so that you know that you can, you know what you can achieve given whatever financial circumstances you're in.
Okay.
If you like what you see in that, and typically, I guess, so that you've got a bit of a ballpark, what we would normally do is the average person on, say, a $50,000, $60,000 family income, after 15 years can usually achieve a net worth of between $2 and $3 million. Now, if we said then that at that point they chose to retire, that would mean that they've probably got property worth $4 to $5 million, and they've probably got $1.5 million or so in debt. They might choose to retire, sell off the properties that they need in order to pay down the debt. And if we said property gives you around about a 5% return, yes, I know before you take calls on this, it doesn't get 5% in Sydney at the moment, but people who read my books will know I don't advocate investing in Sydney anyway.
Right.
Then if you've got a $2 million property portfolio, you've got $100,000 a year income. So you can know that you can retire at that point if you think that's enough for you, if you think that $100,000 a year is enough, which it probably would be if you had no debt or anything like that.
Right.
So I guess we're giving people a goal, an endpoint, and a plan, and a desire to move toward that and support along the way.
That's very good. Okay, so what's the next step after that for someone? They do the plan, they go back, and they actually monitor and track as they go, do
That's
they?
Right. We monitor and track. We give you a fantastic piece of software. My husband's absolutely brilliant, and I think the reason that he's brilliant is because he's not necessarily just a software engineer. He's been a police officer. He's worked on his own financial situation. He works with clients in the field, so he gets an opportunity to write the software that people can use and want. It's very user-friendly. It's all Windows-based.
Yeah.
He's just done a wonderful upgrade to it, so it tracks all of your properties, all of your loans, all of your income, all of your expenses. It just does such a complete tracking job that basically, if you don't, I mean, all you've got to do is use it 15 minutes a week and you're on top of everything. It's fantastic.
Now, is this available to anyone who just wants it, or do they have to be clients?
No. We've made that specifically for our clients. So even though I think it's worth a lot of money, it doesn't have a dollar value on it because only our clients get it. We do have a lot of people who have been after that software. We have a lot of big companies who have wanted to buy it off us. But we'd like to keep it for our clients. We'd like our clients to be able to get that and nobody else.
That's great.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. Again, we're not interested in getting into the software sales market. We're not interested in making money that way. We're keeping that exclusive for our clients, and it's just a wonderful tool that they get.
So if anyone's interested in checking out your services, where can they go to find out more?
Oh, the website, edestiny.com.au. That's going to tell people everything, all about the books, about the services, just about anything they want to know, basically.
Sydney property, Australia property, where are we?
Okay.
Is it safe to go and buy property now?
I'm really glad that you've asked the question because I've just come back from the Sydney Investment Expo on the weekend, and the numbers were quite good there, but a lot of people were sort of reporting, oh, we did about the same business that we did last year. I had probably twice as many people at all my presentations and twice as many people come back to the stand. And when I sat back and thought about that, I realized that it's for one very good reason. As property investors, we've always thought differently than a share or a managed fund investor. When somebody invests in a share or a managed fund, they do so for two reasons. Because they want income first and growth second, unless they're a very long-term investor, and then they'll look for growth. But generally speaking, over the medium term, people who invest in those instruments will look for income and growth. When people invest in property, what do they normally say? They normally say, I'm going to buy that property because it's going to go up in value really quickly. And all they think about is growth. People invest in property and often lose a lot of money in the short term in the form of the extra money they've got to pay for the upkeep on that property in order to get what could be a big gain in the future. It worked for a lot of people who invested in Sydney. But here's the problem. If you invest for growth, traditionally you go to those areas where your rent returns are low in comparison to the price you pay for the property, which means there's going to be a difference, and often a substantial difference, in the income that you get in and the expenses that you pay out, including your loan interest. When there is a big difference, you've got to fund it out of your own pocket. Now, if you buy a property, Gary, that's say you've got to put $75 a week out of your own pocket into it to support it, how many of those do you reckon you can afford to buy?
A few.
Okay, so you've got a lot of disposable dollars at the moment.
Mm.
Okay. What about the person you know down the road who's maybe on a $50,000 a year income with three kids. How many lots of $75 do you think they can afford?
With the kids, maybe none.
Okay, maybe none, maybe one.
Yes.
So let's say they can afford one. Let's say they can afford two. So they can afford $150 a week from their own pocket. And their property skyrocket in value. What can they do with it? They can't leverage against it because they can't afford any more lots of $75 out of their own pocket. I like to teach people how to invest in property that, first of all, probably has a good chance of growth in the future, but that's not the driving factor. It has to give them cash flow today. Now, to give you cash flow today, there are two ways you can get that. You can get that by either finding property where the rent return is higher for the purchase price than normal. I found a couple of those the last couple of nights when I've been surfing the internet. There's a couple of fairly large centres around the country that have that Bundaberg. I'm not going to tell you too many of them because I'm about to buy property in some of them and I don't want people to run off and buy the property that I'm looking at.
That's right.
Bundaberg, Mildura, Mount Gambier, Geelong, Ballarat, Bendigo, Toowoomba, Ipswich, those kinds of properties. They're close to a capital city. They're big regional centres in their own right. Rent returns are quite strong. Property prices are still fairly low.
Yes.
When you buy property like that, usually you get more income than you need and you have extra money left over. Now, if you had extra money left over in a property that you'd bought and it was a property that you'd mortgaged, what would you do with the extra money? Either put it into another property or pay it off the mortgage so that you're creating equity, and that's the same thing. That's creating equity to put into another property as soon as you could.
Yep.
So you'd use the cash flow to do that. There's another way you can get cash flow as well, and a lot of people don't understand this well, and this is where you've got to be smart. This is where you've got to be educated. Some properties have high amounts of on-paper depreciation attached to them. If they've been built after 1985, they qualify under tax laws for construction depreciation and for depreciation on everything inside the four walls. Sometimes some properties, particularly if they're a unit where there's a lot of common property and you get a share of the depreciation on that, have high amounts of on-paper deductions. So you might get $8,000-$10,000 in the first year in on-paper deductions. When you get an on-paper deduction, what happens is you get some of your tax back. So if you're on the 50 cents in the dollar tax bracket or the 47, you've got $10,000 worth of depreciation, you get $5,000 back. When you add that $5,000 to the rent return, often it's more than you need to pay all your expenses. And once again, you've got money left over, but you've already paid tax on it because it's the tax return essentially that you've got left over.
So it's definitely worth checking
that out. It's knowing how to check. Yeah, how do you do it?
Yes.
Because when you look at a property, how do you know? Now, I'll tell you what I've been doing the last couple of nights. The next day, I've been calling the agents for the properties that I've been finding. My very first question is, how old's the property? When they don't know, which they usually don't know, I say, find out and get back to me. They find out and get back to me. I need to know the date that construction began because that's when it's timed from, the date that construction began. Providing it's after 85, I know I'm in the ballpark. Once I know that there's going to be depreciation on it, I've actually formulated a table in my books with some rule of thumb figures. It says a $300,000 townhouse will probably have about this much depreciation in it. Then I can go back to the free software that you get with all of my books, and there's a cash flow calculator there, and pop in that amount of depreciation and see whether or not that property is going to deliver me a positive cash flow.
Ah, so they, people get some software with your books as well.
Oh, yeah, they get free software with the books. They don't get the big tracking software, but they get some software with some wonderful calculators, cash flow calculators, loan calculators, stamp duty calculators, tax calculators, a whole lot of things are in there. Readiness to invest, you can work out when you're ready to invest. There's a calculator for that. Buying and selling worksheets. It's got a lot of really good stuff on it.
Okay, so now you're talking about using the internet to do all this searching.
Mm.
Now, you know, you're not going to see those properties, are you?
Oh, absolutely not. I don't look at my properties before I buy them.
So a lot of people out there say, you know, you should look at it, you know, particularly if you're a first buyer or, you know.
Why? Why do you have to look at the property? People want to look at the property because they want to get a warm, fuzzy feeling, don't they?
Yes.
Well, I can tell you some of the best performers in my portfolio would not give you any kind of warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, you'd look at them and you go, ooh. I remember when I bought my property in Perth last year, and I settled on the same weekend that I was speaking at the Money Show. And of course, the word got out that I'd bought property in Perth, and everybody wanted to know where it was. So they all came up to me and said, "Where have you bought your property?" And when I told them, they all went, "Ooh." And I said, "I'm not going to live there. It stacks up as being a viable investment." Now, I've had that for a year. I've had a 20% growth in value, although that's not why I bought it. I bought it because it gives me a positive cash flow. I have money in my pocket every week from that property.
Yes, a lot of people like to look at a place so that, you know, they can actually know it exists.
Oh, well, you know it exists. You can't, I mean, the searches are going to show you that it exists when you go to buy it. So you're not going to spend money on property that's not actually there. You've got a lawyer who does the conveyancing for you. I think people want to look at it so that they can make sure that it's okay. I mean, the realities are other people are going to be my eyes. If I see a property and I get to that stage where I'm close to making an offer on it, I probably ring another property manager in the area, not the agency that is selling the property, but another one, and say to them, "Look, I'm about to buy this property. I'm going to need it managed, and you know, you might get the job. Would you be willing to go out and do a quick inspection on it now?" And send them out now, and they'll go and they'll do a condition report and everything for me. They'll be able to see what I could see. As for structural defects and that kind of thing, I wouldn't know what those were anyway, even if I went to see the property. So I'm obviously, once I've made the offer, going to have a building and pest inspection done for those things anyway.
So you use the experts for the things that you don't know or don't have the knowledge for?
Yes.
Okay.
And use other people to be my eyes if I need that. I do get some photographs and that kind of thing, but I've got to be careful, Gary, because I'm probably one of the most emotional people you're ever going to meet. You know, I'll become caught up in the emotions. And once you become emotional about a property, you lose your objectivity.
Yes. Now, we're not out to buy a house to live in.
No, exactly.
So we're not necessarily want the beachfront place, which is beautiful mansion, because we can't afford that.
Well, we can't afford it. It's not going to be positive cash flow. It's not necessarily going to make a viable investment. And even if you can afford to buy it, you can only afford to buy one of them, and you'll never be able to afford to leverage anyway.
So it comes back to the focus. The reason why we're doing this is for an investment to get us ahead in our financial plan.
Absolutely. And the same thing applies to people who want to buy a property near where they live. You know, when we buy property as an investment, we tend to cast the net 5 kilometres around where we live.
Yes.
And that's where we buy. I think people do that for a number of reasons. First of all, it justifies your own decision to live there. You think it's a good area just because you live there. And it might be a good area to live, but not necessarily a good area to invest in. They're not always exactly the same thing. The other problem I have with that is, first of all, most people don't live, or a lot of people don't live, in areas where there is a positive cash flow anyway. And of course, I wouldn't buy anything that's not positive cash flow. And if you already live there and you already have one house there, surely buying a second one is the same as putting all of your eggs in one basket. Because property behaves in cycles, but not the same cycle all over the country.
Yes.
And it could be booming in one area and plateauing in another. So unless you're prepared to spread your investing over different property types and different states in this country, then you are never going to access the best capital gain across your portfolio. So you shouldn't buy close to where you live. People do so also because they want to keep an eye on it.
Yes, very much so.
I can't think of anything worse. I don't want to watch what other people are doing with my property. I've got a property manager. I've got landlord's insurance. I've managed my risk. I don't need to see it every day.
And that's an important thing. You must manage your risk.
Risk management is the single most important factor, and you manage risk two ways. Firstly, by getting a positive cash flow. Because when you have a positive cash flow and interest rates rise, you don't worry.
Yes.
I haven't been worried about the interest rate rises because I've got a positive cash flow that manages that for me. I don't have to dig into my own pocket for that. The cash flow also manages vacancy. So if across my whole portfolio, I have a positive cash flow of about $1,000 a week, or it's probably about $800 a week. So if I've got any one property vacant at any one time for a couple of weeks, it's no big deal. My
Yes.
cash flow manages that for me quite nicely. The second way that we manage risk is through landlord's insurance. And you should never buy a property unless you're prepared to take out landlord's insurance. That covers me for loss of rent in the event that someone damages my property to the point where it can't be tenanted. It helps me to recover any rent by giving me the pay my legal costs to recover my rent. It covers damage. It covers a whole range of things. And it costs me about $5 a week on each property.
It's nothing, is it?
It's nothing.
Yes.
It's like having a car and not having that insured.
That's right.
Same kind of thing.
Yes. Margaret, we're just running out of time, so can you give our listeners your top five tips for investing in property?
Okay, my top five tips are, first of all, don't get emotional. Very important. So remain unemotional. If you think you're the emotional type, don't go and look. Do what I do. Find them on the internet. Get photos if you have to, but never ever go and look. I'll have to tell you, real estate agents get a little bit surprised when you're not going to come and look, and they really want to show it to you, but that's only to make them feel better. Tip number two would be always get a positive cash flow. If you want to be a growth investor, fine, but understand what that means to you in the short and long term and do your calculations. The next tip, which is tip number three, would be to make sure that you do spread. One of the things that's happened in my portfolio is that I have some fantastic performers and I have some that aren't doing much at all, but as a group, they tend to be doing really, really well. And it's a little bit like dollar cost averaging with managed funds, where you put money in consistently and you're always buying at different prices, but overall you buy at a better price. If you spread your investing over different property types, then you're always going to do better from a capital growth point of view.
Very good.
So that's important as well. Tip number four is to have a plan and to have some kind of income and expense management plan. Even when you're getting ahead and you're like me and you've got a lot of properties, then you still need to be watching what you do every day. You still need to be careful about what you do and how you manage your money. And I guess the last tip that I have is don't think that you have to spend a lot of money on education and courses and that kind of thing. Get educated. But there's a lot of ways that you can do it without spending a lot of money. Go to anything that's free, go to anything that costs hardly anything, and buy as many books as you can. Don't think that you don't need education. You do. As a property investor, you're probably not an expert. We don't have an instinct. You can't use your instinct now. Now's the time to know about facts and figures and to get as much education as you possibly can. Find some kind of strategy that you like and stick to it.
Okay, very good. And if anyone wants to know about your books, your business, or even about when you're actually running some seminars,
Yes.
they can visit your website, which is
Destiny.net.au. That's destiny.net.au.